said, and a trustworthy and experienced physician. So this physician, this doctor, this expert in the science of medicine, he should be experienced. He should have knowledge of his trade, and also he should be trustworthy, and he should be honest. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at that which the people of every land cannot be without, in the words of Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Western world, in particular the U.S., has been at the forefront of leading a maximum pressure campaign against Iran. This campaign is a multi-pronged one that includes economic pressure and also funding terrorist groups and actors meant to carry out acts of sabotage inside Iran with the intent to create instability and ultimately regime change. Iran's leader has accused the U.S. of having a crisis group which does just that, especially against the Islamic Republic. This is the topic of this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Elijah Magner, journalist and political analyst, joins us from Brussels. Also joining us, Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, who joins us from Toronto. Welcome to you both. Elijah Magner, first over to you. This is what Iran's leader has called a crisis group, where he said the American government has created it, and its mission is to search for the points which they think can be used to provoke a crisis in Iran. Is the U.S. guilty of that?
Of course, this is something that the Americans and their NATO allies have been working on against Iran, to submit Iran, since 1980, when President Carter imposed the first sanctions on the Islamic Republic. And since then, there have been sabotage, there have been attack, all attempt to change the ruling system in Iran just to submit the Islamic Republic, and all these have failed. And we have seen in the last few years all the riots that attacked all the civilian infrastructure, the banks, the ambulance, and the latest one in Kurdistan and Sistan, Baluchistan, all with one objective, with the hope that there is a possibility to change the ruling system from within. So establishing an operation room and exchanging intelligence information, cooperating to curb Iran's will to continue having this ruling system that is decided by the population in a democratic voting, It was incompatible with the U.S. and its allies' objectives in the Middle East and West Asia. This is why these attempts will not cease, because today Iran has shown its capability to impose deterrence on the U.S., on Israel, and even on all the NATO allies that are within the vicinity of Iran, with all the military bases that are surrounding more or less Iran and are spread in the Gulf countries. For that, Iran should expect that these attempts will continue, and there will always be, every single president will always attempt to do something in Iran in order to gain some support among the warmongers in Washington.
All right, so Iran's leader has called them, Zafar Bangash, crisis points, of which some of the points which are at the top of the list, I'm sure there's more of them, include religious differences, ethnic differences, and also the issue of gender and women. Tell us why you think the U.S. has chosen those three specific areas, and how does it go about executing them?
You see, in every society, there are different religious groups, there are different ethnic groups, and of course, the latest onslaught from the West on Muslim societies in particular, but even the rest of the world, including Africa, this gender, women issues that they are introducing into society, because they feel or they think that they can exploit these differences by playing up on people's religious differences or ethnicities, as well as this gender issue that they are pushing even in their own societies, although there is a resistance from the people within Western societies as well. So Washington, which obviously leads the Western world in terms of formulating policies, it has embarked on these latest points, although there are others as well, as your guest has pointed out, that the Islamic Republic has been targeted since the Islamic Revolution was successful in 1979, and the first sanctions were imposed in 1980. And subsequently, of course, there have been acts of sabotage, of assassinations, an eight-year brutal war, which in fact would be this year, September 22nd, would be its 43rd anniversary, that was launched from Iraq when it was ruled by that tyrant Saddam Hussein. And when that war failed, of course, then these other acts of sabotage, assassinations, etc., and these trying to instigate religious, ethnic, or gender differences are being used in the hope. And I believe it's a useless hope, because it will not materialize. But at least, you know, the warlords in Washington, D.C. continue to play on these, assuming that somewhere or another they might be successful.
All right. I don't know if we can maybe get into some details. I'm hoping maybe, Elijah Magner, you can help us out on this. I mean, it's one thing for the U.S. and their officials to sit at the White House and promote regime change in Iran, or promote the support for, let's say, players or groups who have aspirations for separation or their own autonomy, and to create, let's say, or stir unrest within Iran. But in order for that to materialize, there's got to be some support coming from the U.S. to back up their words. Can you tell us the different ways that the U.S. maybe has done that, whether it's through financing, arms, or whatever else that maybe you can tell us?
Well, wherever there are religious differences and different ethnic group, as your guest rightly said, if you look at Iran, there are many ethnic groups, and there are the Sunni, the Shia, there are Jew, and there are other religions that represent the minority. The Americans have tried to work on the sectarian issue that can have a very fertile ground in the Middle East, particularly due to the ancient Islamic ground of differences. And for that, they have found ground in Iraq and then in Syria, and they tried a little bit in Lebanon and in Palestine. It didn't work after many years of devastating wars in Iraq and in Syria, and they almost succeeded in Lebanon. However, they have failed because at the end of the day, the axis of the resistance turned the matter into something different. The compass was toward Palestine and not toward the differences between Sunni and Shia. And these differences can be organized between the Muslim sects. On the other hand, we see how the Americans concentrate on the ethnicity. Look at Russia. There are 190 different ethnic groups. And what the Americans do is they go for this ethnicity and they promote the independence of each group, even in a small area of the country, just to divide the country. Wherever there is a country that has natural resources or it is not submitting to the U.S., a color revolution, that's the latest model that the Americans are bringing when all their wars have failed in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Yemen. And now with the color revolution, they come with big titles like human rights, like democracy, like Western values, and all these are fake because here in Europe, we don't really live in democracy. The democracy is a big title under which, and a big umbrella, everybody is hiding whenever they want to attack the country or impose sanctions on the population to really make the population suffer, because sanctions are against people, not against government. Mm-hmm. So for that, this is how they can do it. Particularly when they finance it and they print the dollar, they can invest a large amount of money for wars. This is their model. They can't invest money to boost their own economy domestically at home, but they have money for wars. So what they do is very easy. In every country, there are people willing to collaborate and to start riots from a very small incident that can happen. And you have all the mainstream media supporting it.
Sure.
Because the Americans and the West has a strong access and control to mainstream media, then they can amplify the message and they can show that there is kind of a war in the street when really there are a few riots happening here and there and the local security are controlling it. So by doing this propaganda, they can show to the world like the population don't want the regime they are living under and they want a different system. And this is how they can manage to create some havoc in the hope that they can succeed. So far, they haven't succeeded.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Maybe we should do a flashback here, Zafar Bangash. I'm going to go back to the year, roughly 2007-08. George Bush Jr. was in power, and there were talks about Iran's civilian nuclear program, which the U.S. thought that Iran was weaponizing. And given the fact that there was no breakthrough, based on a report that came out, there were the CIA allocating a budget in which it would help opposition, what they called militias, on the borders of Iran in terms of ethnic minority groups in order to stir up unrest. They actually had a budget that was set aside. It came from the CIA budget. And there was proof of that when later on you had Fred Barton, who was a former U.S. State Department counterterrorism agent. He said that the latest attacks inside Iran that were happening at that time were in line with U.S. efforts to supply and to train Iran's ethnic minorities to destabilize Iran. This goes beyond sitting in the White House and wanting change. And this is this just defies the rules of international law. But of course, we can see how the U.S. is engaged in that, in such types of activities. What do you think about that? And do you think that the U.S. is still doing this?
Well, absolutely. The U.S. is actually, you know, they are habitual troublemakers. It is in their genes to try to overthrow governments that refuse to submit to American demands, or governments that want to pursue an independent policy for the benefit of their own people. So we should not discount that at all, and also keep in mind that despite the fact that there are a lot of social and economic problems inside the United States, but it continues to spend billions of dollars on wars as well as on these kinds of disruptive activities to undermine governments that refuse to surrender to the U.S. And the Islamic Republic of Iran is a particular target because it has had an Islamic revolution. It has maintained its independence. And it offers an alternative to the rest of the world that it is possible to break out of the stranglehold of American hegemony. So while the CIA continues to finance these disruptive groups, and regrettably in every country, there will be people, and I'm sure there are people in the Islamic Republic as well, of course, a very tiny minority, but there are people that, for the sake of money, would indulge in these kinds of activities to advance the American disruptive agenda. And of course, the Zionist regime is also involved in it. We know that a number of Iranian scientists have been assassinated in the Islamic Republic, and these have gone on with the support of the Zionist regime that has found agents within the Islamic Republic. So the United States, of course, has been doing this historically. We can go back to Iran's own history as far back as August of 1953, when the democratically elected government of Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown through a CIA and MI6 engineered coup. There have been repeated assassination attempts, sabotage, wars, etc., inflicted upon the Islamic Republic, and indeed in other countries around in the region, as well as in Africa and South America. So America is a perennial troublemaker. It disrupts other societies, attempts to disrupt them in order to bring them under its control. So I don't think that we should have any doubt in our minds that it's doing that even today against the Islamic Republic of Iran.
All right, so that's the whole point behind this maximum pressure campaign. So, when we take a look at it, Elijah Magnier, by all accounts, it has failed because it has been going on for quite some time, decades, obviously, whether it's on the economic front in the form of sanctions, or whether it's through the examples that both you and our guest there from Toronto has cited. Even U.S. officials have said that this maximum pressure campaign has failed. Why do you think that the U.S. continues down a failed path?
Because the U.S. doesn't understand the Iranian culture. And because the U.S. believed all the way since 1980 that by imposing sanctions, it is a possibility, there are a strong possibility to curb the Iranian influence and Iranian will. But this didn't happen, and every president tried, even until we reached President Donald Trump, that imposed the maximum sanctions. But these maximum sanctions turned positively on Iran because Iran was forced to be more independent and rely on itself, and increase its own production and defend itself with all the precision missiles and the drones that imposed a balance in the Middle East and in the West, where the Iranian military capability showed how powerful they are. And this is why the Americans still don't understand that imposing sanctions is not the way. Well, I think that was gave also another positive result, because today Iran is part of the Shanghai Organization, is going to be part of the BRICS in January 2024, among all the countries that have enough of the U.S. sanctions, of isolating, of the Americans isolating them on the SWIFT, and they have decided to first use the local currency, secondly, to rely on other means to exchange goods and trade. So Iran, with all these years of being under sanctions, can offer its experience to all these countries. And this is why the Americans are starting to understand today that their sanctions are turning against them, because they didn't succeed with Cuba, they didn't succeed with Venezuela, they didn't succeed with Iran, and they're not going to see it in the future. And this is why they're thinking of alternatives today, because the will of the population cannot be defeated.
The whole notion of freedom of expression under a democracy has been shattered with the double standards, Zafar Bangash, that the U.S. has exercised by shutting down many channels that Press TV is associated with, especially online. And we just had Australia actually do the same, of which it seems like they believe that this is the way to go, even though they preach their democracy. Why is it that they cannot see how what they are touting and preaching, yet they break it when it comes to the Islamic Republic, that it still won't work?
See, in the West, this notion of democracy and freedom of speech is trotted out when it serves their interests. But when people begin to exercise their right to freedom of speech, then they shut it down because that goes against their interests. So, as you pointed out, you know, they've shut down Press TV, their allies here in Canada, they've done this, in Australia, you know, in Britain, they're targeting these platforms and these media outlets, because they're bringing out the truth to the people. And truth really terrifies the Americans, because they want to control people's thinking. They don't want the truth to come out. I mean, in fact, you know, even there was a Gallup poll last year, which found out that only 31% of the Americans approve of their government's operations and their government's performance.
Sure.
That means 69% of the Americans don't approve of their government. So in other words, they are losing this battle, and that's why they want to clamp down on these other media platforms that are providing information and accurate news to the people.
You got 1 minute here, Elijah Magnier. Protests in France, the police came out and violently tried to suppress it. You have protests that happened in the UK. Same type of approach was used in the U.S. The best example was that insurrection, where you had the people that were actually jailed because they actually, well, they did what they did. Yet when Iran is clamping down on the riots because, for example, the Mahsa Amini ordeal, then Iran is blasted for it. Why is it that they think in their country they can do it, but when Iran does it, it's not right?
Because we are expert in double standard, and our hypocrisy doesn't have a limit in the West. Because I recall on a letter received by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, when he was told, when he just started his job, that we use human rights and freedom only against our enemies, but not against our allied dictators. This is the answer. We have double standard, which we use everywhere.
Thank you very much. Elijah Magnier there, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Batawe and the team, it's goodbye. Oh.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I am Asma. I have the honor to be your host. And as for today, we have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita. Welcome to the studio, sisters.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to be with both of you. And since it is the ritual in here for the guests to introduce themselves, I would like you to very much briefly introduce yourself and give us a little bit of background about yourself.
I am Zainab Askari, and I am actually from Indian administrated Kashmir. And I have been living in Iran for some 9 years now.
Yeah.
And before that, I have done masters in linguistics from Kashmir University, and then I joined Hausa in Qom.
Assalamu alaikum, my dear sisters and dear listeners. I am Bita, and again, I have the pleasure to be here with you too, especially our listeners. And I'm studying medicine in Tehran, and that's it.
Best of luck in whatever you're doing. Religion is not just something that comes to you or is just passed away to you through heredity or just, I don't know, it comes to you just like by heritage. I suppose when you are born in a family with a specific sort of religion, it is not count to be the very starting point of your religious life. The starting point is actually the sparkle that starts to glow in your mind, and then you go for studying more and more, and then to accept a religion for your own self. That is going to be the starting point, not the point where you were born in a religious family, because that is not going to count. Because many of people are born in religious families, but they did not carry any sort of religious ideas in their mind. So let's talk about that starting point and that sparkle in our lives.
I think this actually discussion is going to be really interesting because everybody has its own journey in Islamic world. And, it doesn't matter where you were born. I mean, your family may have some backgrounds for you about religion and something like that. But there is a time, I think, in everybody's life that I call it a revolutionary time.
Exactly.
There is a revolution in your soul that you will find your way, your path, and your everything, your ideas, your beliefs, your opinions. Everything is kind of... place itself in a right way, you know, and after that is the time that you are going through perfection and you are in the road. And I think it differs a lot. I saw a lot of people who found their ways at the age of, for example, 50 or 60.
Exactly.
And there are a group of people who just found it in young ages, like 15 or 13 even, you know. And for me, myself, if I want to tell you, it was like I was born in a family with these religious principles, and this background matters. There are a lot of people who tell that, no, it doesn't matter. I'm the one who chose it. Yes, you are the one who chose it, but this affects a lot.
Of course, yeah. You know? Those who say it does not have any effect, I guess, are big fat liars.
Exactly. And it was about around the age of 13 that I find myself asking questions about the philosophy of me, I am, who the creator of this world is.
I have, alhamdulillah, I was born in a family, my both parents were Muslims, and I was born in a society where I faced a huge identity crisis throughout my life, because when we were sent to school, we were informed by our parents. The criteria for sending us to schools was to learn better English, learn better, have better secular education. And for that reason, our parents, they admitted us in a very hi-fi school, a competitive school, which definitely was not, everyone was not Muslim around. And we were informed by our parents, just to be social in your school, don't introduce yourself, who you are,
mm-hmm.
or what background you come from. So we were like... growing up in that school and then having always this pressure from the family to not express your identity was like, why do I belong to a religion I cannot express?
Yeah.
Until I was like grown up to some like 15, 16, and then I started thinking, no, I should be able to be myself and at the same time to able to defend myself, what kind of religion I have. Then I come across the books like, you know, I open up the Quran and try to contemplate it, and I try to understand it. And unfortunately, I don't understand anything because whatever I was picking up was a difficult translations, which I really was not able to understand.
Which is a problem for those people who do not know Arabic. But of course, right now and nowadays, they can refer to translations.
Right. Different sort today of we do have a lot of resources, but like in the times when we do not
when
had
there was
much,
no much
enough
access
to internet and other stuff or other literary books like that, or you live in a country where Muslims
things are not
live
easily available.
Yes.
You were born in a Muslim family, but the society was just the reverse. And then there was this identical crisis that happened to you. And then at the background, you had some sort of Islamic things in your house.
Right.
So that made you think. And they started to work as
trigger.
The sparkles.
Right.
Let's keep it there and then go for a short break. And then we'll be back to hear the rest of your story. Welcome back. You're listening to your favorite program, Back to Reality. I'm Asma, your host. Sister Zainab and Sister Bita are sitting in here and we're having a beautiful discussion. Well, the journey of Sister Zainab is a little bit of a long journey. And we're just, I guess we're at the very
got the
ending
long
part.
Story, very short. I would say I actually got recognized with the real Islam in Iran itself. I think up to that period of time, I was not really aware about the Islamic things. Although I was a Muslim, although I was living in a Muslim culture, what I had practiced throughout my life was only to wear a hijab since.
So from a non-Islamic society, you came into a Islamic society.
Right. So I think I really got recognized with the real sense of Islam only some 9 years ago.
So the changes are very much visible to you.
Right. You know what? The changes that we can see in the story of our sister Zainab is somehow so visible, you know. My story is not that visible, you know. The changes that I went through was somehow the inner changes in spiritual
exactly.
ones. You know what I mean? And, you know, in this road, I had two blessings. At first, you know, my family background that I talked about. And the other blessing that I think we all have is the era and the time that we were born in. And in this time, you know, there are so many facilities, so many things that can help us in order to search, in order to have more knowledge, in order to ask our questions.
And there are also
you know?
Those who can deviate us.
Yeah, exactly. You know, at the same time that we have the blessing to know more,
there are some dangers in the way
danger
as well.
To know more about what, you know?
The question is, what make us think more about religion? What are the triggers that made us go through that mental search for the religion?
You know, the first trigger I faced was my school. You know, I was in a school that all the students were so curious about these questions. And whenever a kind of religious scholar came to our school, we were like, okay, this person, we're going to suffer him to death because we're going to ask him a lot of questions about everything that came to our mind. And sometimes these questions are the triggers. And the questions were triggers for me, you know, asking about everything. And
you must
you
have a good
go.
Mentor, actually.
Exactly.
Because that person is going to do a lot of good things for you. And
exactly.
If they are not knowledgeable enough, they can deviate you.
I think, again, for me, that was... I used to make sure that I sit in the Soha Kumela. What would trigger me was that this huge assembly of people, all of them, you know, reciting, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, all together, that had some tremendous attraction in itself. I was like, who are they, like, calling to? Is he listening? Is he answering? Is he there? Does he even exist? And then, you know, looking around yourself, looking at the order, like I had a science subject, luckily, those days, and our teachers would tell us, like, the heartbeats are like, you know, the science writes, it's lob-dob. But then we had a Muslim teacher who would say, like, it's actually rub-rub. A heartbeat, the sound of our heartbeat is rub-rub. And we have... we have heard this, we have practiced it, we have actually experienced that in the labs. We have very carefully heard this sound. So, you know, looking at the human anatomy in itself.
Exactly, yeah.
Made me actually reconsider.
Oh, that who much can of create discipline in a body, in a human body, and not just in a human body, in nature as well. You see, from a seed that does not have anything in itself, right, and it's just something like
that grows up
useless
into beautiful.
A tree can come out, right, and from that tree, fruits would come out, and then an entire village would eat up, right, from that
tree.
Just
a human body in itself, like this complex structure, but at the same time in order, everything in its place. And there was my mom was reading some of the book once, and I told her, can you give me the summary of this book? She told me, like, Imam Ali Alayhis Salaam has said that if you convert entire human body into thread, it will make 3.5 rounds around the whole globe, just one human body. So all these things would, you know, the human body, the science,
all
these
things would work as a trigger.
Right.
Yeah. So now, let's just go for a short break and then we'll be back in no time. And then we'll have more for the last part of today's episode.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So if I want to say it and talk about the triggers, I would say that personally, I myself, just as I was going through studies in my time when I was a teenager, there were some books that were having some titles like In Search of God. And then reading more and reading more, I just went through, just as you said, in society you see something, among your family you see something else, in your brain there is an entirely different thing. All these paradoxical ideas get together and then you feel like, okay, there are too much of paradoxical feelings and thinkings in my mind and in my thought and in my heart. So I just want to give them an order, a direction. I want to know where am I going to. And then you come across the concept of death. Whenever there was a person who was just buried in front of me, I was just looking at that and think of my life. Okay, was it all? So this is an end to my life? And then all of these questions started to make me feel, okay, I need to know more and I need to understand and set the setting for myself. I have to have these basic thoughts and ideas, and I have to have this creed so strongly in a way that I get a hold of it and then know what I'm doing.
Right.
And all of these things really would push you into the direction where you find your true path. Mostly they would happen in your teenage time when you're just a teenager. But then there are some people who would get into that point in their 50s. And then they leave for just 2 years after that, but they end up as martyrs. We have it in history and we have it in our religion. Many times we...
So I think everybody has their own special and unique way to find your ways. You know, you may have different blessings, different triggers, but at the end, we all are human beings, and human beings have the same fitrat or nature.
Yeah.
And this nature have the strong
urge. You should look into
urge.
Your inner part.
Exactly. And this actually nature has the strong urge to find the right path and to worship the Allah Almighty.
Exactly. Yeah. So, Sister Zainab, your final word?
Yeah, I think one of the best things my parents did with me was they were open to discussions. They were like, there was a Christian friend who gifted me Bible, and I was like looking at my father. He said, accept it, because Quran says, "Afala yatafakkarun," why don't you do tafakkur, why don't you
just read it and go for the best ideas.
Yeah. And I would find very much fit in the Islamic perspective.
So this is also another important factor. We must have some discussions, and the parents or the society, the schools must be open to this. With knowledgeable mentors, of course.
Right.
Pick the best one for yourself.
Right.
Of course,
it should not be genetic, really. If it's genetic, it's a disaster again.
Yeah.
And I think this was one of the very beautiful things that helped me make my faith very, very firm was intra-religious discussions and knowledge from all the friends. Gathering that, and we did have some common points.
Yeah, thank you, Sister Zainab, and thank you, Sister Bita,
thank you
to our listeners. I hope it was fruitful for you. So wherever you are, I hope God to be on your side forever. And thank you for staying with us. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Here at Arabi English Radio, express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 30th of Safar, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Rizal, peace be upon him, Dave's infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
It all started with smiles and warm applause as Ursula von der Leyen began delivering her annual State of the Union speech in the European Parliament on Wednesday. The head of the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, painted a rosy picture.
Together, we have shown that when Europe is bold and united, it gets things done.
The atmosphere in the chamber soon changed.
À l'appel de l'histoire.
It's time to come down from the ivory tower. One third in the EU, millions, don't have enough to eat because of inflation. You didn't say a single word about them today.
One lawmaker even questioned how von der Leyen can sleep at night.
95 million people in the EU are threatened by poverty. There is a broken energy market while the energy and arms industries are making record profits.
The Commission President was told the so-called working poor are being ignored. Experts confirm it is a growing phenomenon in the EU.
People can be homeless and have a job. There's in-work homelessness, but there's also groups that are higher risk of losing their job from one day to the next.
Von der Leyen told lawmakers she's proposing €50 billion for Ukraine from the EU budget up to 2027. This is in addition to the huge amounts of money being spent on Ukraine by individual member states, most of whom are in NATO, where military spending is also increasing. Not to mention the EU is developing its own army. A number of legislators criticised the EU's position with regards to Russia.
The failed sanctions policy, sorry to say, that hasn't really helped Ukraine in any meaningful way. It hasn't brought the end of the war any closer, but it's hurting the European economy and European people.
Slovakian MEP Miroslav Radatovsky claimed the real purpose behind the war in Ukraine is for the United States to occupy Europe and the world. Separately, a number of lawmakers criticised how refugees are treated by the EU if they are not from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The
Vatican envoy Cardinal Matteo Zuppi has landed in Beijing for a three-day meeting with China's high officials. The People's Republic of China and the Vatican have not shared diplomatic relations since 1951, so this will be the first high-level meeting between the two states in more than 70 years. The Vatican's initiative is aimed at paving paths to peace in Ukraine. This, as the European Union has done almost nothing to ease tensions in the conflict, as Italy's Vice Prime Minister said during a press conference on Wednesday.
A smaller state like the Vatican is doing much more for ending the conflict in Ukraine than the European Union. I wish the Vatican envoy best of luck. I hope the war will end soon because it has multiple ramifications. Poland's government decision to call on the EU to further extend the embargo on imports of Ukrainian grain is one of them, and it is highly worrying.
Vatican envoy Zuppi has also traveled to Kiev and Moscow in June and to Washington, D.C. in July as part of attempts to bring Ukraine and Russia to the negotiating table. However, high officials in Kiev have excluded the possibility of Vatican success in resolving the military conflict. More specifically, Ukrainian authorities have said Pope Francis cannot mediate in the Ukraine war because he is pro-Russian. The head of the Holy See, Pope Francis, has often angered Kiev and those supporting Ukraine in the war with Russia. If on one side, the 86-year-old pontiff has repeatedly expressed sympathy with the Ukrainians, on the other, he has also expressed understanding for Vladimir Putin's strategy in Ukraine by saying NATO was barking at Russia's door by expanding east, and lately by praising Russia's imperial past.
I'd like to point out that the Vatican's geopolitical approach to this conflict is multilateral. That's why the papal envoy has already been to Ukraine, Russia, and the US. The Holy See believes that holding a neutral position can open doors for peace initiatives, in contrast with the interests of arms suppliers.
Since February, Beijing has been promoting a 12-point peace plan, which features, among other things, a ceasefire, a resumption of peace talks, and the termination of unilateral sanctions against Russia. However, Ukraine has replied to China that it would not accept any peace proposal involving loss of territory or freezing the conflict. Max Civili, Rome.
They have waited years for justice that will never come. Mark Kelly's sister, Carol Ann, was murdered during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
12 years of age, she was shot in the back of the head. She was shot behind her left ear. And there is absolutely no reason in the world that anyone can give any parent or brother or sister as to why their little sister should be murdered on her own street at the front door of her house.
Mark and hundreds more in Northern Ireland may never have closure now under the UK government's so-called legacy bill that grants immunity to IRA volunteers and to British soldiers for historical atrocities there. It's proving a huge test for Anglo-Irish relations, too. Amid a chorus of criticism from around the world, the Republic of Ireland is weighing up a human rights case against London for the first time in more than five decades.
Everyone, no matter who was affected, whether you were affected by IRA violence, paramilitary violence by the state itself, everyone has a right to justice, some kind of justice, and the very least to investigate whatever had happened to their loved ones. I mean, and that's just the basics, Article 2 of the European Convention, you know.
Under the new legislation, if anyone accused of murder gives information to a so-called truth recovery body, they'll escape prosecution, an attempt, many say, by the British government to hide the truth.
There were hundreds of IRA volunteers that went to jail during the conflict. But if we look at, in stark contrast to British soldiers or the paramilitary RUC, not one ever served a full sentence for the killing of civilians during the conflict. In fact, a number of British soldiers were let out early and given medals once they went back into the British Army. So there's a stark contrast between both. This is really about immunity for British soldiers.
The legislation is now going through the House of Lords, where it's not expected to receive any amendments. And after that, it's going to receive royal assent in just a couple of days. But the victims' families say it's not going to deter them. in their pursuit for justice.
3,500 people were killed during the conflict between Protestants loyal to British rule and the majority Catholics who wanted to break away from it. 2,500 of those cases remain unresolved, and it's those who have already paid the most who are being asked to pay again. Saeed Pariza, London.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has told European Parliament Foreign and Defence Committee members that Ukraine will join the military alliance.
Ukraine has never been closer to a membership in NATO than now.
Having allegedly provoked Moscow for years, Stoltenberg was accused at the hearing of now turning his sights on Beijing under Washington's direction.
China has not illegally invaded and bombed a sovereign country in over 40 years, while the US and our allies have hardly stopped in the same period, killing millions of civilians, displacing millions more.
NATO's 31 member states have been called on to stop dithering over the question of providing long-range missiles to Ukraine.
They need these ATACMS, the long-range missiles.
Security analysts say Ukraine joining NATO and the country being supplied with long-range missiles are two moves that could trigger nuclear war. We've been asking members of the public if they are concerned.
It's so far-fetched for us as normal citizens, the thought of that, but I think it should be regarded as a possibility.
When you know that only 5 nuclear bombs can like destroy the whole planet, I don't think we're going to get to that point.
As the conflict rages on with no mention of peace negotiations, the European Commission has just cut its Eurozone economic growth forecasts. But commentators point out that wars are very lucrative for some. And in reality, they suggest, the US-led NATO alliance has nothing to gain from peace. NATO is merely justifying its existence. That's the damning assessment of some legislators.
You said that Ukraine is gradually gaining ground. That's not true. Since you were here the last time, Ukraine has lost territory. 500,000 men are dead.
Some lawmakers point out that corruption in Ukraine is still a major problem. Oleksiy Reznikov was recently pushed out of the country's defence ministry. He was considered one of the West's closest allies. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
...24-year-old Chris Carver left behind a fiancée and an unborn child. His family is still engaged in a bitter fight for justice as they consider his death a murder.
Chris was unarmed at the time of his death. It was caused by a single shot fired by a police officer through the windscreen of a car he was driving in South London. Since the tragic day, his family have said multiple times that they truly believe that if Chris had been white, that the police would have responded very differently. And it's quite possible that he'd still be alive today.
On Saturday, supporters joined his family members for a demonstration outside police headquarters and later the British Parliament to maintain pressure on the authorities.
We've got a police force that, in our opinion, is out of control and they need to be brought to justice. This is a young man that was unarmed. He was chased by the police down a road at 10 o'clock at night. And there is no repercussions for those people that chased him. We stand with the police. We stand with the family when they say that if Chris was white, he wouldn't have been killed. Chris has been chased and he's been killed because he's black.
An officer involved in the incident has been suspended. However, 1 year on, Carver's family have yet to find out if the police gunman will face any criminal charges. A murder investigation is underway, but the family has expressed frustration at the slow progress of the procedure. To this day, no British firearms officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter after firing their weapon on duty in the UK. Activists believe this may be the case to set the precedent, as complaints of racism against the British police continue to grow. Robert Carter, London.
It has been 22 years since the Pentagon and the two World Trade Center buildings were attacked by planes. ushering in a totally unexpected and deeply destructive era of world history. As usual, in big cities and small towns across the United States, 9/11 was remembered with ceremonies and the same propaganda slogans from decades ago.
22 years ago, hatred and terror did not win. It did not destroy America. Freedom and democracy and the very pillars of this great nation continue to endure.
The biggest domestic legacy of the death of 3,000 civilians may be the internal spying, repression, and paranoia which immediately followed and continues today.
We've gone into a permanent emergency state. That's the key. And it began right after 9/11 with the passage of what was called the U.S. Patriot Act. Everything's a crime. Everything's an emergency. The SWAT team raids in America, which are crazy. It's where police are dressed in military gear here. They crash through doors in the middle of the night. They've shot children, old men, veterans. It's so far gone, it's going to be very difficult to roll it back.
Washington's unprecedented and digital domestic dragnet would soon be copied by their allies, especially the United Kingdom, France, and the European Union.
All the great dictators said this, is that we need a sleepwalking people. You need to make people afraid. Once they get fearful, it's called the government needs national security. We need to clamp down everybody. We need to arrest people. And we saw a lot of that, by the way, right after 9/11. It's a way to promote hate against everybody in the world. They don't want us to get along. They want us to disagree. And long as we're disagreeing and fighting, they remain in power.
Washington's vengeful response to 9/11 was their declaration of a so-called global war on terrorism. It is now blamed for causing 4.5 million deaths, directly and indirectly, and the displacement of 45 million people. However, there's little domestic discussion regarding the awful impact of Washington's militaristic response on the anniversary of 9/11 or on any other day.
The events of 9/11 transformed our nation and how we view our national security. It also transformed each of us individually in ways that we don't always talk about publicly.
The prisoners of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, the militarization of American society, the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, so many murdered non-American civilians. 22 years after, the list of victims of 9/11 is still growing. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
One year has passed since the fatal shooting of a British black man by a London Metropolitan Police officer, an incident which sparked a huge protest movement across the UK and demands for police reform amid widespread accusations of racism. 24-year-old Chris Carber left behind a fiancée and an unborn child. His family is still engaged in a bitter fight for justice as they consider his death a murder.
Chris was unarmed at the time of his death. It was caused by a single shot fired by a police officer through the windscreen of a car he was driving in South London. Since the tragic day, his family have said multiple times that they truly believe that if Chris had been white, that the police would have responded very differently. And it's quite possible that he'd still be alive today.
On Saturday, supporters joined his family members for a demonstration outside police headquarters and later the British Parliament to maintain pressure on the authorities.
We've got a police force that, in our opinion, is out of control and they need to be brought to justice. This is a young man that was unarmed. He was chased by the police down a road at 10 o'clock at night. And there is no repercussions for those people that chased him. We stand with the police. We stand with the family when they say that if Chris was white, he wouldn't have been killed. Chris has been chased and he's been killed because he's black.
An officer involved in the incident has been suspended. However, one year on, Carber's family have yet to find out if the police gunman will face any criminal charges. A murder investigation is underway, but the family has expressed frustration at the slow progress of the procedure. To this day, no British firearms officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter after firing their weapon on duty in the UK. Activists believe this may be the case to set the precedent, as complaints of racism against the British police continue to grow. Robert Carter, London.